Embedding the Institutional Repository at the University of Lincoln by Julian Beckton. Hello, I'd like to welcome listeners to this, my very first podcast. And as it's my first podcast, I hope you'll bear with me, as I'm very new at this. And because I am very new, I would very much like to hear your comments, and so I have provided a feedback form on the blog where the podcast is posted, and I promise I will listen to your comments and hopefully either act on them or reply to them in future podcasts. Anyway, the topic of this podcast is the development of an institutional repository at Lincoln University, or rather it's the embedding of an institutional repository at Lincoln University. I suppose I'd better start by explaining what a repository is. For those of you who have never heard the term before, a repository is a digital archive in which academic staff, and sometimes students, deposit the outputs of their research. The point of having a repository for a university is to provide a sort of shop window in which the university can show off its academic wares, as it were, to prospective students, prospective customers, prospective employers, and so forth. Now, I said that a repository was an archive of a university's research, and that is usually true. However, at Lincoln, we designed the repository to have a second function, which was to hold high-quality teaching materials. In effect, what we were doing was developing what is known as a dual-purpose repository. That is a repository that holds both research and learning objects. Now, there are some objections to this in the repository community, and that's because learning objects tend to be slightly more awkward than traditional research papers. They come in different formats, so they require often different software to play them back. And obviously, the repository has got to be able to handle that. Secondly, it can be quite hard to define actually what a learning object is. They do tend to come in a variety of different formats. And of course, thirdly, learning objects are never really finished. They're always being developed. You know, a lecturer might work on something and that will work for this student, but something else will come along for next year and the learning object needs to be developed a little bit further. Fourthly, there is no tradition of depositing learning objects as there is of depositing, or if you like, publishing research papers in higher education. And there's not really a culture of using learning objects in higher education. Now, I have to say that I am rather sceptical about the whole concept of a learning object. Most of us, as academics, are vaguely aware that almost anything we produce will be out of date next year. That's not to say there are not learning objects that might well have a long life. You can think, for example, of the periodic table of the elements, language dictionaries, parish registers for historians, variety of maps, law reports, colour wheels for artists, and so forth. But when you think about it, those kind of learning objects tend to be already published, either in print or on the web. If I develop a learning object myself, it's likely to be highly contextualised to the class I'm teaching, which then would ask the question, well, why would you put it in a repository? Because nobody else is teaching that class. But there are exceptions to this. For example, I developed a flowchart that demonstrated how an allegation of plagiarism is dealt with at Lincoln University. Now, that does sound very institution-specific, but with a little bit of imagination, somebody could take it out of the repository, adapt it for their own institution, and then put it in their repository, so it will be available to lecturers in their institution. But it has to be said that for most learning objects, the virtual learning environment's content store is perfectly adequate for most requirements, but not for all of them. And that's where our repository came in. It started out in the School of Architecture, who actually wanted to store and deposit student work from previous years in order to teach current students. Now, the sort of work that architectural students do tends to be rather unconventional. A student project in architecture often involves the creation of a 3D model, as well as the usual range of briefs, specifications, photographs, maps, site plans, and so forth. Well, obviously, there's a bit of a problem in trying to get a model into a repository. So what we did was to work with the architects to submit a joint bid for funding based on the concept of a virtual studio, which we envisaged as a sort of electronic atelier. For those of you not familiar with that term, an atelier is a sort of artist's workshop, and the distinguishing feature of which is that the people who work in it are usually surrounded by current and past project work. Now, in common with most universities, space tends to be rather limited at Lincoln, and we simply don't have anywhere to put these models in the physical real world. It's also very difficult to index and catalogue them in a consistent way. So this, then, was our first challenge. We needed a repository which could handle a wide variety of media types. Now, there's more to that than just describing the resources adequately, though. Different types of resource come with different requirements for browsing and previewing. You need thumbnails of pictures, embedded viewers so you can play video files, And of course, you also need the keywords and tags that a database of text files would have. So what we did was we worked with ePrint Services, who are one of the leading software providers for repositories, to develop this kind of functionality. And up to a point, we have achieved it. But inevitably, there was a fly in the ointment. In fact, what we were developing fell far short of what the School of Architecture actually wanted. While the data model we were offering was pretty much okay, what they really wanted was a much more visual way of browsing the repository. And an example of that can be seen on the website of the MAIS project, and the link to that is on the website, or the blog. Now, this kind of functionality was way beyond what we had been funded to do. You might think that this left us rather high and dry, but not a bit of it. We still felt that it would be right to offer some kind of support for multimedia, because many of the disciplines studied at Lincoln are not entirely text-based. The output of a research project in art design, for example, might well be an exhibition. Media research might produce a film. Animal behaviour science uses video all the time. Now, these subjects might also produce teaching materials that could take advantage of the repository in those formats. Even if we were to refocus our project on a research repository, we'd still need to make sure that it had multimedia capabilities. If, for example, a researcher in art design did produce an exhibition, our repository would still have to have the ability to handle pictures. Now, when we started, repository software didn't really offer this kind of functionality. It didn't do a lot of the things people working in the visual arts needed. Or rather, it didn't do it at a price we could afford, which I suppose is a subtle distinction. So, for example, a common tool in a slide library is the light box, in which slides are mounted on an angled backlit box. The electronic equivalent of this is essentially a display of thumbnails. Well, that's easy enough to manage if you just have pictures. But our images, though, could well have been in different ePrints, i.e. different deposits in the repository. So we came up with the idea of something a bit like the shopping cart you find on an e-commerce site, where you can add an ePrint to your own collection. Now, I'll admit that this is still rather crude. You can only create a personalised collection of different ePrints. You can't as yet select individual items from different collections, but then you can save the relevant images from your collection to something on your own local drive. And as the project progressed, we and the architects both realised that the repository wasn't quite what they needed to prioritise at this stage. They certainly still had a need to store student work, but another side of their project was the idea that students would work collaboratively together to develop and refine a project. So we developed a wiki to meet this need within Blackboard using the Learning Objects LX wiki tool. I'm not going to talk about that now, except to say that some of the outputs of that collaboration may in future be deposited in the repository. And we haven't entirely abandoned the idea of depositing models, although what we're actually, I think, is likely to happen is that we're going to be seeing the use of CGI to recreate the models. There is already in the repository, again, there's a link on the blog to this, but we've actually created a CGI recreation of a fly-through of a model of the existing School of Architecture. But here we were. We were now left with a project for a repository that had been funded, but nobody actually wanted. Actually, that's not quite true. The university badly needed a conventional repository for research materials, so we changed the emphasis of the project so it focused much more on the creation of a research repository, while still providing that support for learning objects, which we felt was important. So we had moved from developing an innovation that was clearly wanted to one that nobody had asked for, that we thought would clearly be beneficial, but nobody really thought it was important. There was nobody championing it, if you like. Anyway, at this point, I think it would be useful to turn a little theoretical and refer to the work of Everett Rogers, who back in 1962 developed a theory of how an innovation is diffused. I oversimplify dramatically, but I think his argument boils down to five basic points. Number one, an innovation will be more likely to succeed if it is perceived as an improvement on what went before. Number two, an innovation will be more likely to succeed if it matches the values of those who are adopting the innovation. Number three, an innovation will be more likely to succeed if it is easy to use. Number four, an innovation will be more likely to succeed if it can be adopted at a piecemeal rate. And number five, an innovation will be more likely to succeed if the benefits it brings can be made highly visible. And by succeed, I mean widespread adoption by people within the university. I think there's another model that's also very useful here, and it's to do with e-learning, but it's still relevant. It was developed by Betty Collis and Jeff Mernon in the Netherlands, and it's called the 4 E's model of e-learning. And the 4 E's are the environment, by which I mean the institutional support for the innovation, how easy it is to use, a bit like Rogers, engagement, which really is about how academic staff can develop their careers and benefit from engaging with the innovation. And finally, educational effectiveness. Is it going to be helpful, or rather, do they believe that it will be helpful to their students? Now, a repository isn't strictly speaking e-learning, but I think both of these models offer a useful framework for thinking about how the use of a repository can be spread across the university. Even if an innovation ticks most of those boxes, it doesn't mean people will go for it. The fact that citrus fruits can prevent scurvy was discovered in 1601. Now, it took nearly 200 years after that for the Royal Navy to adopt the carrying of citrus fruits on ships, or make it compulsory, and it was nearly 300 before the Board of Trade made it compulsory on merchant ships. But it's interesting to note that the Navy was much faster to adopt new ship and gunnery designs, because those innovations matched the values of the decision makers. Clearly, health and safety was not a priority for the 18th century Admiralty. But I think it's true to say that a repository certainly has to tick all of these boxes if it's going to be embedded. To some extent, Collis and Moonan's first one is checked by the fact that it is, by definition, an institutional tool. Yet it's not enough to provide the repository and leave it at that, which takes us back to Rogers. Is it an improvement on what it has replaced? And you might well ask, well, what has it replaced? There was nothing like a repository before. Now, there are a whole suite of strategies around what is going to go into the repository and what is not. Is it linked to the wider institutional strategy? How do we bring the repository's existence to the attention of those who can benefit from it? Now, I think this is the most important, because institutional strategies, whether on research or on teaching and learning, really aren't that widely read, if we're honest about it. I think we're missing a big trick, though. What's very important is that the repository needs to be seen a key part of a university's IT portfolio. It's as important, or at least we like to believe it is, as important as the VLE, the portal, the library catalogue, the corporate website, the intranet, or whatever other big ticket systems that we have. And the problem here lies, I think, in the way that repositories have been set up. Or, perhaps if I'm more honest about it, the way we chose to manage the project. While the external funding has been very welcome, and probably the repository wouldn't have happened without it, what happened at Lincoln is that the project team really didn't get the attention of the Central Computing Services team, and the repository became, at first, at least, as far as they were concerned, a bit of a nuisance. Actually, that's a bit harsh. And we did work with them to resolve that, but it was a lot of extra work. But I still think it's true to say that the repository doesn't really enjoy equal billing with the other big ticket systems, and that's something we have to address. For example, we could have a desktop icon for the repository on the desktop, although I suspect these days that would rather get lost in the morass of desktop icons that are typically found on the staff desktop. There might be something to be said for going back to the old Windows 3.1 ideas of groups of icons, where you could have a university systems folder or something like that. But let's go back to these arguments about why you shouldn't have a dual-purpose repository. Remember, earlier I said that there were five arguments against having a dual-purpose repository. One of these is the problem of the end user. Can I make it absolutely clear at this point, and I want to stress this, that this is not the fault of the end user. Nor does it imply any criticism of the way end users behave. The problem is rather this. I might be working on a 42-inch screen with oodles of RAM and gigahertz of processing power. Yeah, I wish. But the user might well be working on a 5-year-old computer via a dial-up modem. Many multimedia tools often require runtime support services. That is, you can't just run them client-side like you can with a PDF or a Word document. They actually need to have a special server or access to it. And that might possibly be integrated into the repository, or perhaps externally in a VLE. But the user has to have access to some software that will play the multimedia files. To some extent, we address this by creating a requirement for uploading proprietary formats, such as JPEG or MPEG for movies. But in fact, users can, if they want to, upload content in any format. But if that happens, then the editor of the repository would raise an eyebrow, and the upload would either be converted by the editor into a proprietary format, or would be sent back to the original depositor with a suggestion that it might benefit from that kind of attention. In terms of media, we've also embedded the Flash Player into the repository, so there is no need for users to have their own media player installed. Well, of course, they do need Flash, but that is easily downloadable and, of course, free. The second issue that I drew attention to, you'll remember, is the huge variety of type of learning resource. There's what you might call rough, informal stuff, you know, like PowerPoint slides from the last lecture I gave, on one hand, and on the other hand, there are commercially produced materials which may or may not be licensed for use in a repository. Now, I think this is a major issue. but it is actually more cultural than technical. At this point, I think it is worth referring to the University of Lincoln's institutional research strategy, which essentially is to establish a reputation for world-class research in our areas of expertise. And we're going to do this by, among other things, conducting high-quality research, which will be pervasive throughout the university. Now, if we want our research to be pervasive, then our repository must cater for all disciplines, and for a variety of different formats, or different output formats. Now, that should allow us to cater for learning objects. We can then say that teaching materials that are the outputs of the research are appropriate for the repository. But that doesn't get away from the problem that any repository has two major barriers to its use, and this question of what should be put in is the first one, and that's related to the institutional strategy and the design of the repository, and the second is the actual process of uploading, which I'm going to come back to later. Remember, we set out to create a repository that will be able to deal with a fairly distinctive type of teaching material, that is, a material around a specific architectural project, and the characteristics of that were that it is multi-part and multi-format. But for most people, a teaching resource is nowhere near as complex as that. It's, well, a handout or a set of PowerPoint slides. And frankly, these aren't the sort of things we really want in our repository. Now, let me say right now that we are not making any rules about formats. If you happen to have a set of PowerPoint slides that are instructive, valuable, and will be of use to people in your discipline outside the University of Lincoln, then they're exactly what we want in the repository. But the question is then, who decides on the quality of the material? We certainly don't want to get into a debate about whether repository staff are centering academics, but on the other hand, we don't want to discourage people from engaging with the repository either. I think the only answer here has got to be careful one-to-one interaction with depositors. If a user submits something that we think is inappropriate, we certainly shouldn't shy from rejecting it, but we should always try to make suggestions about how to render it more appropriate. There's also the question of checking the copyright status. Now, we've taken a fairly conventional approach to copyright in the matter of research materials. We use the Romeo database, and we will chase up rights holders if we think there's a problem. But learning materials tend to present a rather wider problem. Much as we might disapprove of this, we have to be honest and say it's not unknown for academic staff to include in a PowerPoint presentation, say, the odd image for which they don't actually hold the copyright. The reality is, the rights holders aren't going to know about that, and even if they did, the defence of fair dealing would probably hold, provided that's just using class. It's actually much harder to maintain such a defence if the image was to be published in a repository and made publicly available. And finally, there's the question of appropriate metadata. Unlike a research paper, a learning object might well cover a large number of topics, so there is a question of how the object is keyworded. And there's a whole set of metadata also about the context in which a learning object is used. Is it designed for first-year chemistry students, first-year history students, second-year geography students? There's a whole set of fields about the educational level of the learning objects, which courses it might be used for, and so on, that need to be thought about. So, what we actually did was to create a new object type for the repository, which we called a project. Remember, this was originally designed to hold work by students. And the project object type has two additional and mandatory metadata fields, unit code and year. You can add extra spaces to this field if a resource is going to be used by more than one year, so you can identify it as such. We've also added a little bit of Web2 style functionality using the outputs of the SNEAP project, so users can add their own tags to items they find in the repository. We've also added RSS feeds, so users can opt to be updated on topics of interest to them when the papers are deposited in the repository. Now, we're certainly not claiming that this is anywhere near adequate for a fully functioning learning object repository, but we do think it goes some way to addressing some of the issues. There is an argument that learning object repositories ought to support direct authoring, or at least have close integration with authoring tools. I disagree with this view. I don't think a repository is, or ever will be, a first-choice authoring environment, because there are better tools out there, and colleagues will always have their own preference for whichever tool they use. And in any case, the primary function of a repository is preservation and not creation. That said, there is certainly a case for conversion tools that can promote preservation. For example, we've included a Word to PDF conversion tool because we think that PDF is a better format for longer-term preservation of documents. Well, as far as the multimedia content is concerned, we're currently using proprietary formats such as JPEG for images and MPEG for movies, although this is done outside the repository environment. And actually, we're quite often we're using Flash for movies these days as well. There is also no consensus about the need for learning objects to be preserved at all, when you think about it. This makes the kind of mandated deposit that research repositories argue for rather difficult, if not impossible, to achieve. I mean, I suppose you could argue that research mandates are also quite difficult to achieve. But the focus with learning objects is likely to be on national or sector-level repositories rather than institutions, which I think makes some sort of sense. As long as institutions are getting reward for their research excellence, they're going to want to show the research they do off. There's no equivalent funding for teaching excellence, at least not in the same model of funding, so there's no incentive for an institution to show off its learning materials in the same way. There is, though, and this is an important caveat, there's an interest in making course materials available. A famous example is the MIT OpenCourseWare project, Academic Earth, which you may have heard of. Again, there's a link on the website, and Lincoln's own Academic Commons. It isn't easy to get people to use repositories for teaching material. Actually, I don't think it's that easy to get them to use them for research either, which is why that is the focus of our advocacy campaign. I do think advocacy is the way forward here, and it's not just a matter of producing glossy publicity material, although that is important. In a university environment, it really is all about meeting people's needs, so you have to work with them. I suppose another issue is that issue of uploading and downloading materials. And who should do it, why should it be done, and so forth. The use of managed electronic learning resources as a teaching strategy is far more common in further education than it is in higher education. So the most mature and large-scale practice tends to be in a further education setting, which is actually a very different context from where most open access institutional repositories are actually being developed and deployed, which of course is in higher education. An illustration of this is the fact that even our Blackboard content store isn't very widely used, although there is our Department of Computing Services, which does mandate a particular style of learning object and insists that all its staff use it, but that's fairly unusual. I think we also should acknowledge the fact that we are ourselves repository folk, if you like. And I think this leads us to forget that for most of our colleagues, there are considerable technical barriers to uploading material to a repository, and we need to address these. If you go for a self-archiving model, you're asking your academics to do several things. Decide what type of resource it is, identify appropriate keywords, what the peer review status of the object is, and so forth. Now, you might say, well, that's why we have repository editors rather than a free-for-all deposit process. And I think you'd probably be right about that. But it gets even more complex when you're uploading a multi-part file. But here the problem is not really with the repository, but with what we can reasonably expect users to be able to do, which in itself is actually indicative of a common problem with technology. If you have a project, which is what we call a multi-part, then you have to zip it, and then you have to upload the zip file. And all this isn't necessarily intuitive to academics, even in disciplines where you might expect it to be. And of course, that's not to say that all academics have a problem with this either. I mean, many are very competent. But I think it is complicated enough to be a barrier for a significant number of people. We are also aware of the SWORD project, of course, which does appear to be useful, but I don't know that there is any getting away from issues about appropriate formats, you know, particularly for preservation, and accurate and properly descriptive metadata being put in the right fields. Now, while the repository editor provides a useful function, you could also see them, I suppose, as something of a doorkeeper. No matter how much you try and say they aren't, I don't think you can very easily get away from the image of them as quality controllers, because actually they do have that function. And if they're not a member of an academic discipline, well, they might not have that level of credibility with the members of that discipline that they need to do the job properly. But I think you can get around this by making a very clear definition of what their role is. Now, as you've probably gathered by now, I actually think there is a small role for a research repository in hosting learning objects, but I do agree that there are some serious technical issues around doing so. I don't think we're in the business of producing full-scale multimedia repositories, because at the end of the day, we're academics with our heads in debates in our own disciplines, and frankly, we don't really care about content object models, or at least we don't want to have to care about them. But that just brings us back to the cultural problem about selling the repository to users. As I said earlier on, we started out with the ambition to produce a learning object repository, and we ended up basically with a research repository with the capability to handle learning objects if need be. But even with that format, it still needed selling to its users. And we've adopted a number of strategies. I mean, we are planning an advocacy campaign. It's really important that we do that. There are a number of other things we've done. Firstly, in common with many repositories, we have a browse page which shows you which parts of the university have actually been using the repository and which haven't. We've also embedded a JavaScript feed into staff web pages, or rather we've given staff the option of having that feed embedded, which will show on their web page the last 10 deposits they've made into the repository. We can also actually incidentally use that for their last 10 blog posts as well. Again, there's a link to my page in the blog entry which shows you how that works. This has proved very popular with staff, and because it is of course an excellent way of showing the world what they're doing in terms of their research. But it is still very, very early days for the Lincoln repository, and we really do need to do quite a lot of work in convincing our colleagues that the repository is going to be useful to them. Like I say, we certainly need to have a relatively traditional advocacy campaign. We're about to have a launch event. We've begun to produce publicity materials, and we're continuing to develop the idea of web links and feeds. But of course, advocacy campaigns are all very well, but they're not necessarily sustainable over a long period of time. Most of the work in ensuring that innovations are effective needs to be done with the people who are going to be using them. That's why we need to develop a strategy for addressing non-use by faculties, based on the theory, I think, that academics tend to have disciplinary rather than institutional loyalties. We also take every opportunity to raise the issue at faculty teaching and learning committees and at faculty research committees. I'm actually also quite attracted to the idea of having repository editors in each faculty, which I believe is a strategy that's been employed at the University of Liverpool. We're certainly trying to get immediate colleagues, that is in my own department, to use it in the hope that they will become evangelists for the repository, if you will, and we are meeting with some success with this policy. Another thing we're doing is to make use of Google Analytics to get a sense of how it is being used. Google Analytics, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is a very useful tool in that it can show a user of the repository not only which of their deposits are being used, but also where, geographically, the visits to the repository are coming from, i.e. visits to look at their particular deposits, which is actually quite an interesting tool for a lot of people. Although we do need to make it, I think, a bit more public. Well, anyway, I think I'd like to conclude by saying, recapping if you like, that we started out trying to build a learning object repository. We ended up with a research repository, albeit one that can handle learning objects reasonably comfortably. It's been an interesting experience, I think, for the Lincoln repository team, and I'll be the first to admit that we haven't entirely cracked the cultural issues yet, namely the issue, in particular, sorry, the issue of what sort of learning objects should be put into the repository and why. But I do think that encouraging people to deposit their learning objects will also encourage them to deposit their research, and vice versa. And I'd like to thank you all very much for listening and for your patience in sticking with what's been a rather longer podcast than I planned. Goodbye.